Hello, everyone, and welcome to True Crime Boulevard, a true crime podcast. And I am your host, Bree. This episode, we're going to be talking about the Golden State Killer. So, content trigger warning, this episode is going to be talking about murder, abuse, kidnapping, assault, rape, breaking and entering, stalking, animal abuse, all of those creepy things. And if those are things you cannot handle right now, please take care of yourself and your mental health. And I hope to see you in a future episode. So, this is a case that had me go into a super duper deep dive, okay? I found out about this case probably in 2016, 2015, just like randomly watching different documentaries and things. And then probably around 2017, I got really into this case and I went on a deep dive, okay? I was stuck in this case for months. This dude was able to be stay hidden and stay in the background for 50 years. And like I said earlier, he did everything. Nobody could find him. He just, like, it was like he was trying to commit, like, the perfect crimes. And, like, in a way, he was. He didn't get captured for 50 years. I mean, eventually he did. But also with, like, the changes of, like, DNA and stuff. Like, this case starts in the 1970s and ends in the 2010s. Well, technically it ends in 2020, but we'll get there. So, I got most of my information for this particular episode from the podcast My Favorite Murderer and the podcast The Murder Squad. I also watched I'll Be Gone in the Dark. It's a documentary on HBO Max. It's also a podcast. Both are very, very good. The documentary chronicles, obviously, this case, but also this case from the eyes of a web sleuth, true crime reporter. Her name is Michelle McNamara. She wrote a book on this case, and she is an amazing writer. I think if you want to do, like, more of a deep dive like I did, that is definitely a documentary that you would want to watch. I think the Murder Squad podcast, more specifically, is a podcast you want to listen to. One of the detectives in the cold case is a co-host. Sorry, losing words here. One of the co-hosts of the Murder Squad was a former detective in this case. And at the time of their recording, he couldn't say much, but he did go talk about the case. He kind of went into detail, so I definitely say go listen to that. All that will be in the show notes down below. So we're gonna go ahead and hop into this. So this guy was known by many, many names. He started out as the Vasilia Ransacker, then he was the East Area Rapist, then he was the original Night Stalker, and finally he was the Golden State Killer. Why he got so many names, I don't know. He kept jumping from place to place and people didn't want to link him together, but yeah, okay, we'll get there. This case baffles me, okay? But we're gonna start at the beginning. Sorry about that. Definitely just hit my mic. Sorry, y'all. We're gonna start at the beginning. Joseph James DeAngelo Jr. was born in Bath, New York, November 8th, 1945. His parents were Kathleen DeGroat and Joseph DeAngelo Sr. His father was a sergeant in the U.S. Army, and his family throughout his youth was stationed mainly overseas. They were stationed in West Germany at one point, and I specifically bring this up because he has had family members, and his sister, I believe, also came out later and said, like, he was abused by his father. Family members have stated that, like, he watched his sister get assaulted by two airmen while they were in Germany, and he just had a very abusive and toxic upbringing as a child. But by the time he was a teenager, they had moved back to the States. He got his roots, you know, kind of started in Rancho Cordova, California. He got his GED in 1964, and he played a lot of sports growing up. However, this is where people started saying that he was torturing and killing animals. That's never a good sign. We all know what the signs of a serial killer is, and that is definitely one of them. We know it's all not factual either. Like, they don't use that anymore, but I mean, hey. So later in life, he joined the Navy. And I also have to point out, why are so many serial killers in the military? Why do they go there? I need to know. But I digress. He went to the Navy and he served in the Vietnam War. He served for about 22 months. He was basically like a repairman. I don't even remember like the like official name he had, but he was a decorated veteran when he left the Navy. When he left the Navy, he went back to school. He started going to a community college and he got his associate's degree in police science. While he was there, he met his then girlfriend, Bonnie Jean Caldwell. Their relationship ended in 1971. They were together for not that long. They were only together for a few years. Maybe like a year and a half. And she realized pretty quickly that he was manipulative, he was abusive, and she ended the relationship. She's like, I don't want to do this anymore. And he started stalking her parents' house because that's where she lived. And it got to a point where like he tried to like break into her home and like attack her. It was weird. It was a very weird situation. But like her father was home and he took Bonnie, put her in a room, said, don't come out till I tell you to. He went back in her room, dealt with Joseph, and Joseph went about his way. She never saw him again. She does not know what her father said. Obviously, he's never said Joseph has never said what her father told him. But she was just like, I don't know what happened. Like, I didn't even know I was involved in this case. And I say that because he brings her up later. So after that, he went on to get his bachelor's in criminal justice. And with that, he went on to join the police force. In May of 1973, after he finished, you know, like his police schooling, because you have to go to like police school, I guess. He was a police officer in the burglary unit in Exeter County from 1973 to 1976. He worked there. During that time, he met and married his wife, Sharon Huddle. They got married the same year he became a police officer. They had three daughters, and then they eventually separated almost 20 years later. But that divorce was never final till 2019, and I wonder why. Well, in August of 1976, he left Exeter County and he went to the Auburn Police Department. He worked there from 1976 to 1979, and then he got fired for stealing dog repellent and a hammer. And he got 6 months probation prior to being fired. And then he also threatened to kill his boss and his boss's family because he was getting fired for stealing dog repellent and a hammer. Again, nobody thought to look into these things. Like, I just have questions. Why did nobody decide, hey, why are we stealing dog repellent? Maybe we should look at any cases where there were dogs there that were deterred for some random reason that we cannot figure out. Like, what? Okay. Now, I want you guys to remember his, like, police work and, like, timing, right? Because all of his cases, everything he did was in the same time span of where he was working. Like, it wasn't that far. It was no more than, like, 10 miles. Like, in a 10-mile radius, he was always committing crimes in that radius. And he usually worked in, like, the middle of it. He's an idiot. But, you know, in the 70s, DNA and stuff wasn't a thing as much. So, you really couldn't do anything. So, from 1973 to 1976, he was mainly doing, like, this breaking and entering, rifling through houses, taking people's things, going through women's clothing, scattering them about. He was, like, taking money out of piggy banks. But, like, he also was ignoring, like, bigger bills. Like, if somebody had a $20 bill sitting on the counter or something, or, like, in their wallet, he didn't mess with that. He didn't take the wallet. He didn't take the money. He didn't mess with that stuff. But he would take change out of a piggy bank. Okay. So he wasn't taking anything of like actual value, but he would do stuff to let you know like somebody's been in your house. Like he would leave things in like a very specific way so that like making displays so people knew, okay, somebody was here. That's not me. So at this point, everybody's confused. Everybody's like, what's going on? And in 1975, September 11th, 1975, he broke into Claude Snelling's house. Now, this man was a college professor, Claude Snelling. He was a college professor. He had a young daughter, teenage daughter. And about 2 o'clock in the morning, he hears a noise and he's like, he's dealt with people like peeping toms and people creeping through his backyard before. So he's just probably assuming that, right? But he goes down to check on his child, obviously. And when he does that, he sees his daughter being kidnapped by some man in like a mask, or not a mask, what are those things you put over your face? The only thing you see is like your eyes, your nose, just maybe your nose, but like your mouth, like you're basically your whole face is covered. Like he has one of those things on and he's like trying to get his daughter back. And he's like, what is going on? And he gets shot to death by this man trying to kidnap his daughter. And then the GSK, Joseph D'Angelo, he throws the daughter back on the floor and kicks her in the face three more times just for shits and giggles. And it's like, dude, why? You already shot the dad in front of his daughter and you turn around and you just decide, oh, I'm going to kick him in his face. Like, come on, man, get it together. But that was his first murder. Like, that was the first time he had ever killed anybody. So, and December 12th of 1975, another report of a masked man entering a backyard. I'm so sorry if you hear that. My dog just decided he was going to get up and stretch and shake. He just woke up. But another man was like, yeah, you know, I also saw, you know, or heard somebody in the, like, in my backyard. And so detectives were already out on a stakeout, so they just went to the house and they were looking in the back or whatever, and the cop, one cop pulls up on Joseph and he's like, yo, stop, freeze. You know, he got his gun pulled, everything, you know, freeze. And he acts like he's gonna surrender. He stops, he drops to his knees, or he acts like he's gonna drop to his knees. He takes his mask off, and before like the officer could really process what was going on, he takes off. So the officer shoots off warning shots to, you know, get him to stop. He hops the fence, turns around, shoots the officer, like just randomly pulls out a gun. The officer is like, what? So he shoots the officer. When he shoots at the officer, the bullet hits the flashlight. The flashlight shatters. The flashlight's in the cop's hand. It shatters in his hand. So now he has like shards of glass flying in his face and like all over his hands. So he's injured. And at this point, he has escaped again. So in June of 1976, he moves to Sacramento, or like the Sacramento area. And this lines up with when he leaves Exeter County's police force and moves to Sacramento and joins the Auburn County police force. And the Visalia Ransacker stops committing crimes, and out of nowhere, the East Area Rapist pops up. So he goes from burglary to rape at this point. Like, now he's upping the ante. So at this point, if you've made it this far, just know, full content warning, okay? All the warnings are here. Everything's now in effect. He moves to the Sacramento area, and at first he starts hitting like low income areas ish you know, just starting to kind of get a feel for the area, get a feel of the lay of the land, see where people live, see how he can get through like these little like creeks and stuff. And it's really like he's using those skills that he got the from 73 to 76. Now he's using them, like he's really putting them into play. Like he's really trying to like break into these homes, see who's living there. And most of the homes that he was starting to hit were single women. And the thing about this case that's very sad to me, but I mean, I understand why people did it. A lot of these women didn't come forward. There are some that come forward and they're in the I'll Be Gone in the Dark documentary. They do come forward and they talk about their assaults, but a lot of these women have never come out about it. Believe it or not, he actually admitted to it just years later. So he starts attacking these women in their home. He like walks in their home, he shines a flashlight in their leg, he has like clenched teeth and he's talking through his teeth, and he's threatening these women and he's raping them, he's assaulting them, he's like, they're tied up, he's walking through their house eating their food, all kinds of just random things. And these women are terrified, and at this point people are like, yo, there's nothing you can do, like if he breaks into your house, just do whatever he says. Like, they're telling this to single women to like try to protect themselves. People are saying, you know, put bells on your door so that if somebody breaks in, you can, you know, hear the bell go off and you can set off alarms. Like, people are really trying to get women to understand, like, you have to protect yourself, right? So then they're at a meeting, like a community meeting, and the assumption is that he was there. Joseph D'Angelo was at the community meeting because somebody says he doesn't attack a home with a man in it. And after that, he started attacking couples. And it was basically like putting a fuse under his ass because he was going crazy. Like, he just started attacking people. Again, he raped over 50 women. And a lot of these women were like married. Like, it was households with couples and then with children in them. And when he started to do this, he would shine the light in their faces still, you know, still talking through clenched teeth. He had a gun. He had weapons at this point, knives, all kinds of stuff. And he would have the woman or wife tie up the man. And then he would take the man out of the room and like lay him on the floor or whatever. And the ties would be so tight that like their blood circulation took hours to come back even after they were untied. And he was making threats to them, like, if I hear anything, I'll kill you. He would put plates on the men's back and was like, if I hear anything, they rattle or anything, I will kill both of y'all. You know what I'm saying? He would be there for hours and he would just constantly go back and rape the wife over and over and over again. He would get up and he would go get food and he would like walk through the house and he would like eat their food. Like, he would make food and sit at their table and eat. And then get up and go back to the wife and then come back out and like mess with the husband and then hide to make them think that he was gone and then pop back out and scare the shit out of everybody in the house. And then, you know, hours later he would leave like there was nothing wrong. He would just leave. And of course they're terrified because they're like, did he actually leave? Is he gonna come back? Like, what's going on? And you know, eventually they would know that like he's gone and they would be fine and they would, you know, get up and, you know, go to the police or whatever they would need to do to try and, you know, go about their lives. So at this point, it's believed that like he had escape plans. He had plans in place for him to be able to get in and out of the houses, to get quick escape routes, like either by foot or like getting somewhere to like get on a bike to go home or whatever the case was. Like, he had very well executed escape plans. Later on, they found out that he was breaking into these houses earlier and like putting ligatures in like your couch. Like, he would put like ropes and stuff in your couch and he would put all these things in your house so that he could just come in the house and do what he wanted to do, and you would just see him pull stuff out from random places and you would be like, yo, you've been in my house? Like, it just to heighten the terror. But at this point, you know, the police don't even know that. Like, the police are just like, they don't know what to do. They can't find him. They don't know where to turn. They're asking the public for anything. They're getting sketches, all this stuff. And it was like, you know, no one's catching him. So he started making calls. He would call his victims, he would call the cops and say all kinds of stuff. Like, he would call his victims and be like, Merry Christmas, or he would just like breathe heavily into the phone. He had one victim that he called and he was like, I'm gonna kill you. And like, he did this stuff often. Like, when he was raping women, like, he would randomly cry out Bonnie's name, which is why I brought her up earlier. Like, he would just call out her name and like say, I hate you, Bonnie, and all this stuff. And like, the women would be so confused because they're like, my name's not Bonnie, I don't understand. So all of these victims were like, at this point, miserable. Like, they felt like their life, like, this was never going to end. Like, this was just a consistent ongoing thing. And that basically was it. Like, the calls would go until his murder spree started. After that, the calls really dropped and he stopped calling. He was harder to track, and it really did seem like it was like virtually impossible to catch him. So February 2nd, 1978 kind of starts his rampage of murders. In Rancho Cordova, there was a couple walking their dog, Katie and Brian Maggiore. they were walking down a road where like 5 previous attacks had happened. And at this point, I'm sure they were thinking that nothing was wrong. And at some point, there was some kind of altercation. Obviously, nobody knows exactly what that is, but there was some kind of altercation, and Brian was shot and killed where he stood. Katie ran off to try and call for help and all this stuff, and he chased her down and shot her in the back of her head. So many people have speculated, like, maybe he walked in, or not walked in, but maybe they were walking and he was like leaving a crime scene, or like something had just happened that he felt it necessary that these people would be able to identify him if somebody were to come forward. And so he killed them. And I feel like this here was kind of the start to everything, because everything after that, like, just kind of goes downhill. He just adds murder into what he's already been doing, like, to the burglary, to the assaults, to all of this. He just throws murder in there, you know what I'm saying? Like, the first killing that he did of the college professor, like, you can tell, like, that was just, like, spur of the moment, whatever. Like, for him, like, just a spur of the moment, oh my god, this happened. And even the second one was, but it was like the second one was even still more methodical. Like, he chased this girl down to kill her. But after this, he would move to Southern California, and this is where he would get his third name, the original Night Stalker. And if you are a true crime buff like I am, and you've heard of the Night Stalker, this is probably very confusing to you, because it was to me, and I was like, what? So basically, Richard Ramirez, who is another horrible human being, is called the Night Stalker, and he came about a few years later, probably about 5 years later, he came about, and they gave him the name the Night Stalker, and because of that, he got the original Night Stalker. This is, it's a whole lot, and I just can't. So he moves to Southern California, and he's living in like the Santa Barbara area. And in late July 1979, he had like this cool down time, and he didn't do anything. Nobody knew where he was. Nobody heard from him. And then in October of 1979, he attempted to rape and kill a couple. However, they both lived. There's not a lot about them out there, probably because they don't want their business out there. And I can respect that. They want their, you know, privacy, because that's a lot to deal with, especially to have your name just sitting out there like that in public. But then again, he kind of goes undercover, like nobody knows where he's at. He kind of goes for a while, and then he pops back up in December of 1979, and rapes and kills Deborah Manning and Robert Offerman, her live-in boyfriend. And then from there, it's just like a spree, and not necessarily a spree, but like a lot of things kind of happen within like a faster period, even though he would have like little cool down times. But, these also, a lot of these correlate with like when his children were born. Like, he would have a spree of murders, and then his child would be born, and he would take a break, and then he would go on a spree, and then another child would be born, and he would take a break. So that's also very creepy to know. So in 1980, he left Santa Barbara to go to Ventura County. On March 13th, 1980, he murdered Charlene and Lyman Smith in their home. They were both bound. Charlene was raped. Their then 12-year-old son was the person that found them. They were both bound, she was raped, and I believe they were both like attacked, like beaten with something. And then August, he left Ventura County and he moved to Orange County. And on August 19th, 1980, he murdered Patrice and Keith Harrington. And then 6 months later, he raped and murdered Manuel Wittenhoon. He bound and bludgeoned her to death. She's the first person that he like bludgeoned to death, which is like creepy to see. Like, he just keeps evolving and devolving into something more and more twisted and weird. She was found by her mom, which is that was heartbreaking. And then he goes back to Santa Barbara in July of 1981, and he murders Cherry Domingo and Gregory Sanchez. Cherry was found bound, beaten, raped, and she was hit in her head over 10 times, while Gregory was found somewhere else. He was shot, beaten, bludgeoned, and was beaten over the head over 2 dozen times. For a while, people thought this was kind of the end of his spree because he didn't do anything for a while. And then almost 5 years later, his last attack actually happened that we know of. He raped and murdered Janelle Cruz May 4th, 1986. And she was found, like many of the other women before her, bound, beaten, bludgeoned, attacked, raped, all of those horrible things. And her mother found her as well in their home. She was his youngest murder victim at age 18. His age range spanned did like 12 to 47, I believe, was the oldest victim. So he had a very large age range. She didn't care. He just was killing people to kill people. He's a horrible person. So the case went cold after that in 1986. A lot of police forces were trying to figure out what was going on. At the time, there was not a lot of interdepartment communication, so people weren't talking to each other. There were some people that were trying to talk to each other, but for the most part, people weren't talking to each other. DNA wasn't the same. It definitely wasn't being used as much back then. People were still trying to build things. But in 1994, Paul Holes, the co-host of the Murder Squad, he joins the force, and he joins the cold case force, and he becomes a detective, and this is one of the first cases that he gets. So he gets really into it, he gets really involved, but there's not a lot he can do. He does a lot of forensic science, so he was looking for, like, okay, what's the next thing that we can do to try to find this person? But at the time, science wasn't progressed enough for them to really do anything. So then in 2001, once things had grown and things had changed, they were able to match the DNA from multiple crime scenes, match the DNA that were there to say, like, okay, so the same person did these one crime scenes. And they were able to do it in a very smart way where they didn't destroy and deplete all of the DNA so that they later wouldn't have the issue of, like, well, we don't have enough DNA to compare it to. Like, they made sure they had enough. So eventually, Paul Holes was able to get the DNA to a genetic profiler. Like, years and years later, he was able to get it to a genetic profiler. They were able to make a family tree and really map down, like, his lineage to get to him. Like, they got it down to, like, two or three people, like, in total. So, like, him and, like, two other people in his family. And, like, just because of, like, age and time and things, like, it was like there's no way it could be this particular person. Like, I think one of the people was, like, 20. The other person was, like, I don't even remember what the other said about the other person, but I know one of them was, like, either not born or just way too young to have been able to do it. So they were like, yeah, no. And so by March of 2018, so Paul Holes starts working this case in 1994, and he retires from the police force in 2018. His last day on the police force, he is sitting outside of Joseph James DeAngelo's house, watching the house. He doesn't want to spook him, so he doesn't go up to the door, he doesn't say anything, he's just watching the house, he's watching the activity, and they end up getting discarded DNA, which means, if you watch any true crime show, you know that if you are smoking a cigarette and you throw the bud, the police can pick that bud up and take your DNA from it. So they got a discarded DNA to match to the crime scenes, and from that discarded DNA, they were able to get a match and make a confirmation of who this man was, and they got him. They walked up to his house, they arrested him, he went to jail, and they asked him, like, yo, what is this? Like, did you do all this? Like, what happened? And he just basically confessed to everything. Like, he just said, yeah, that was me. I did that. He confessed to 120 burglaries, 50 rapes, 13 murders. But sadly, a lot of these cases were past the point of being able to be tried. Like, you know, statute of limitations were in effect, and they couldn't try him for a lot of these cases. So he only ended up being charged with 13 counts of murder and 13 counts of kidnapping. And in June of 2020, he agreed to take a plea bargain that would take the death penalty off the table. And the specific charges are 13 counts of murder with special circumstances, which is the burglaries, and then 13 counts of kidnapping. So at that point, he was in prison. That was the deal. He will spend the rest of his life in jail. He has multiple life sentences without the possibility of parole. He will spend the rest of his life in jail. And that is the end of that. I will say that initially, they were going to try to kill this man. They were going to try and put him on a death penalty road. But COVID saved that for him. They were like, nah, we're not going to do that because it's going to take too long. And COVID's never going to let that happen. So we're going to let you have this plea bargain. And that's what it sounds like to me when you read it. Like, they originally were like, no, we're taking this. We're taking this to trial. And then COVID happened and they were like, okay, you can have a plea bargain, but you're going to spend the rest of your life in jail. When they asked him why he did this, he said that it was because there was another person living inside of him named Jerry who made him do it. Jerry was the person that was killing people and he just could not break free until 1986. What? No. So yeah, that's the case. That's the case. That's how that went. But I'm sure y'all are like, okay, so she gave us the first few names, but there's the last name, the Golden State Killer. The Golden State Killer is the name that he is well known by now. And the reason for that is because of the amazing crime sleuth, Michelle McNamara. She brought the interest to this case to a completely new level. So this is a little sidebar tangent that I wanted to go on because I really want you guys to go out and read her book, watch the documentary, go read her blog, True Crime Diary. It is so good and she does so much research. She gives life to these people. When you watch a lot of documentaries about this case, the women that are in these episodes and in these things are in lingerie, and Karen Kogaris says this in the documentary, and like, it's so true. A lot of these women are in lingerie and they look beautiful and they're done up, when in reality that's not it. And Michelle McNamara takes the time to go see these victims and talk to these people and talk to the detectives, and she was trying to figure this out. And I feel deep in my heart, she probably like had his name written somewhere, or it was somewhere. They say they can't find it, but I feel like somewhere in a diary on like a random page and like a corner, his name is written because she saw it somewhere. Like, I feel it deep in my soul. And the reason I say that like this is because she passed away on April 24th of 2016, after working so many years on this case. So from 2007 to 2016, she worked on this case. She wrote an amazing book and she gave him the name the Golden State Killer because he had so many names, and she was like, no, just like, California is the Golden State and he was the killer of the Golden State, so that's his name. And that's the name that I feel like really took with him. And she wrote a case, she wrote a book about it. She was obsessed with this case and she wanted the survivors of this case to have a closing. There were people that just lived in the area while this was happening and she wanted them to have an ending to the story. And again, yeah, she passed away. She dealt with anxiety and nightmares and trauma and all this stuff from this case, which is why I always say, please take care of yourself, please take care of your mental health, because true crime can be heavy, true crime can be hard, and you have to make sure that you're putting yourself first. And as great of a writer she is and as amazing of a person she was, and mom and wife, she wasn't able to take care of herself, and sadly she is no longer here with us. She didn't get to see him arrested, she didn't get to see him go to jail and all that stuff. But in her book, she describes this man to a T. She talks about the fact that she thinks he's a military man and she thinks he was probably a police officer and that he probably had a family and kids, and she hits on everything about him. He was married, he had kids, he was a police officer, he was in the military. Like, she was able to make those conclusions and deductions from what she was researching, what she found and what she saw. And at the end of her book, there's a letter that she writes, and it's so profound because I'm sure this is exactly how he felt, and the fact that she was able to put words to it, and it was just like life mimicking her art, which, when I mean art, just like her book. So her piece is called A Letter to an Old Man. I'll leave a link where you can read the entire thing, but this little chunk is really profound to me and just like really hits on probably what he felt in those moments. So she says, "One day soon, you'll hear a car pull up to your curb, an engine cut out. You'll hear footsteps coming up your front walk. The doorbell rings. Take one of your hyper-gulping breaths. Clench your teeth. Inch timidly towards the insistent bell. This is how it ends for you. You will be silenced forever, and I will be gone in the dark." Okay, look. That gave me chills, okay? Like, what? Girl, words. Okay, I see you, ma'am. But when you read the whole thing, because that was just like a little excerpt of it, but when you read the entire thing, oh my goodness, it's beautifully written. And like, she uses his own words against him. That statement, "You'll be silenced forever and I'll be gone in the dark," is something he had said to one of his victims, and she took that and used it against him. And if I'm not mistaken, when he went to trial and they did the case and the victims could do their impact statement, her husband Patton Oswalt, who's a comedian, he went up and read that letter to him in the courtroom so that he could hear it. You know what I'm saying? Like, everybody was like, oh no, he need to hear this, because, you know, in my eyes, she was his, you know, she was his last victim. She died trying to figure out who he was and figure out this case. So yeah, that was the Golden State Killer episode, or whatever you want to call this horrible, horrible person. Yeah, this case was another wild one. I'm really sorry I couldn't give you guys more like names of Kate, like people that were in this case, just because a lot of them have decided to stay silent. They don't want to talk. They don't want to be in the public eye. But again, please go watch the I'll Be Gone in the Dark documentary. It's amazingly done. And you get to learn more about Michelle, but you also get to learn more about this case, because again, she does an amazing deep dive into this case. But I do want to apologize a little bit, because this is coming out on a little bit of a later note on a Thursday. But I told you guys I would be here Thursday. I never said what time. I try to be in the morning, but sometimes life happens. But it's here and it's Thursday, and I love you guys and I appreciate you guys all for listening this week. So you guys can like, comment, subscribe to my podcast pages on whatever place you listen to your podcast. I'm slowly trying to get it to more platforms, but some of these platforms are hard to get on. I'm gonna be honest with y'all. But if you guys would like to reach out to me, give me any tips, if you want to give me cases, suggestions, whatever, just say hey, because you know I like to say hey and talk. You guys can hit me up on Instagram at True Crime Boulevard. That's TRUECRIMEBLVD, because I'm not spelling Boulevard. That's a lot. And you can also email me at truecrimeboulevard@gmail.com, spelled the same way as the Instagram handle. Again, all this will be in the show notes below. So until next time, until next week, y'all, this was a trip down True Crime Boulevard, and I will see y'all later. Peace.